Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. We're taking a look at Louisiana culture this week with Native son Chris Champagne, author of the Yap Dictionary, and Native daughter Cheryl St. Germain, author of Navigating Disaster, 16 Essays of Love and a Poem of Despair. Chris Champagne does a little bit of everything in the laughs department. He's a poet, a playwright, a stand-up comedian, and a lover of all things New Orleans. His first collection of poems was called Roach Opera, which I'm sure you can imagine, and he's back with a new book, The Yap Dictionary, which covers everything from egg to zydeco. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, the Yap Dictionary really takes its place alongside How to Speak Southern, that's for sure, with this distinctive take on our New Orleans dialect.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm kind of excited about it. I kind of happened really quickly. Bill Lavender over at Lavender Inc. emailed me and said if I was interested, and I think I pulled a muscle in my fingers saying yes on the keyboard and tried to put it together as best I could. You know, I did a piece about Yat in another book, New Orleans What Can't Be Lost, and I remember telling the editor, Lee Barkley, that I don't know if I wanted to write an essay explaining it yet because I didn't want to have to get into fights the rest of my life at parties, whatever I went about, if I did something wrong. So I took it kind of serious, and I did research and tried to do the best I could. And I knew that there are some things you can pronounce one way or another and things like that. But so far, knock on wood, the feedback's been pretty good, so I'm really gratified by that.
So the switch from laughmaster to lexicographer is a pretty serious one. How hard was that?
Well, as it turned out, I do have some kind of an understanding of the subject better than I thought I did. I actually used myself as a reference. I went back and looked at some of the Yat sketches that I've written over the years for Gridiron Show and for my own shows, and some of my own poems, because I have Yat poems in Roach Opera. So I mined myself, and as I was speaking and at the grocery store or in coffee house, I would listen to myself speak. And it was ugly. But I tried to take those words down. And one of the interesting parts about it when I did some research is I ran across words that I used to use as a matter of course when I was a kid, like shiny balls, which we used. It was what we called marbles. And I don't know whether they call them that anymore. I think it's derived from that they were made out of China, basically, some of them. And, of course, I wished more than once that I had paid better attention when I was a child to my mom and dad and aunts and just people in general. Often I would put my head down to sleep, put the light out, think of five more words, jump up and turn the light on and write it down.
Aww.
But that was kind of fun, really.
Well, it's a very sound-based pleasure to look through this book, you know, and some of the things we hear every day, like these dem does, you know, and then there's the ER sound.
Yeah.
Like burl.
Burl. I mentioned in a book that it's impossible for some New Orleanians to actually say that sound. I think it's the same as if you come from a foreign country and you learn how to speak at a certain, you know, in a certain other language. There are certain sounds that are difficult as an adult to say. And one of those is I had, when I used to work at the track in Jefferson Downs, there was a friend of mine, her name was Lorna, as in Lorna Doone. And the supervisor was incapable of saying the word Lorna. It was Lerna. Always Lerna. And even after you told him, it was impossible.
Just couldn't wrap his lips around it.
Couldn't do it.
Right?
Couldn't do it.
And then, of course, there's Erster.
Erster.
Pernt. Pernt, I have a hard time saying myself.
Yeah, Pernt. Well, you know, when I do my satire shows, it's Numa, I Know Where You Got Them Shoes, Shex Snyder.
Yes.
I kind of go in and out of my yacht, and it occurs to me in mid-sentence to say Pernt. But then later on in the show, sometimes I forget to say Pernt because I don't really say Pernt. But some people do.
Oh, and a lot of these expressions have to do with food. I wish you'd talk about some of those.
Well, that's one thing that I did look up. I looked up a lot of the food terms because I wanted the book to be for tourists who are coming here. So, you know, sometimes if you're from someplace else and you're not familiar with our food and you look at a menu, you don't know what that is. I made sure that I went back and looked up the dictionaries of those things, like Cubillon and Daube, which is probably something you really don't see that much on menus anymore.
And Daubache?
Daubache. Well, that was an interesting one because that, according to my research, it was invented in New Orleans. Now, it is based on a European dessert, Austrian, I do believe, and I can't remember the lady's name at the moment, unfortunately, and I apologize. So it was Derberge originally, and because we've made it into Daubache, Americanizing it instead of Frenchifying it. And I thought that was relatively interesting. And, of course, St. Vitus Dance is another one that I looked up in that slang dictionary, and it was extremely close to my definition, actually, so I was kind of happy about that.
Well, now you're going to have to start reading dictionaries all the time.
Yeah,
this will be fun.
Well, I have, because sometimes there'll be a word that I think is an American slang, because, of course, you know, we are part of America.
And, we are.
And have been. So a lot of the words that we sometimes think of as being New Orleans, I think sometimes that they're actually expressions, perhaps, or words that also are popular or were popular at some point in America. But then there are other words that I think are like that that maybe aren't so much. And I'm not so sure about, like, for instance, I was looking up sassy last night, and I was wondering, I figured that was probably not so much a New Orleans word, but this was a pretty huge slang dictionary, and sassy wasn't in it, although sass was.
I'm surprised.
I am too. So I don't know. I'll have to look into that for the second edition a little closer.
Well, I hope you find it.
I do too.
And there are some necessary correctives here for our street names too in this book.
Yes. Well, you know, in most of the United States, especially if you have a French name for a street, it's butchered, the pronunciation. Of course, we butcher everything here. So we have the Muses, you know, Calliope instead of Calliope, and I tried to use Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary as a guide to some degree here. So I put little anecdotes to try to liven up the text. And I remember I was in college one night, and I stopped at the Shell station on Esplanade and the Bayou, and these two guys came out to, and asked me if I went to college. So they were having a disagreement about the pronunciation of Calliope Street. So I told them that they were both correct, and I tried to explain it to them, and they would have none of it, one of them anyway. And so I said, well, what's a calliope? He said, well, what's a calliope? So I explained to him what a calliope was and went on my way, did the best I could, tried to break that.
You never know when all these things will come in handy.
Right.
And there are a lot of references to bodily functions of the base or sword, I must say.
Well, there's a few of those, yeah. I'll have to go back and look. I don't think that there are that many, but there's a little bit. It's not G-rated. It's not X-rated, I don't think, either. I tried to, you know, get around it as best I could because those are some of the more colorful ones, actually.
Yes, they are. And they're quite amusing, too. And a lot of love. A lot of love. Hard, hard, hard.
Hard, hard, hard.
And hot.
Hot. Darling.
Yep.
Yeah. There's lots of that. Well, you know, there's a lot of affection in our language.
There is.
Baby.
Exactly.
Everybody's baby.
And
you know, sha. Sha. Well, that's one I got a little flack about because that's not really a yap term, but it's more of a Cajun term than it is a yap term. And I work around a track. There's a lot of people from Acadiana, that jockeys and trainers and stuff. So you're inundated by that a certain part of the year. So I just put that in.
Well, it's just a sweet expression, and we like it. And you're inviting readers to help you with this book now.
Yes, because it's impossible to catalog the entire thing by yourself because certain words were in certain neighborhoods, certain families even, and I couldn't possibly do everything. So, and that was kind of a deflection as well. That way it gives people an outlet so they won't be mad at me for forgetting their favorite word. So we are looking for suggestions at yakdictionary.com. And I have to say I haven't gotten that many so far, maybe about five or six, of which maybe one or two I wish I would have had. And they're words that I know, and for some reason they kind of got lost in a shuffle. But
well, I like this new you, this new dictionary maker. I think it's pretty great.
Well, thank you so much.
We've been talking with the ever-delightful Chris Champagne, creator of the Yat Dictionary. Bye, darling.
Bye-bye.
Cheryl St. Germain is one of my very favorite Louisiana writers. She tells tough truths about her city, her family, and herself. She's a wonderful poet, a crack essayist, and she directs the creative writing program at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. We had hoped to catch up at the Louisiana Book Festival, but instead, we're speaking to her from her home in Pittsburgh about her wonderful new essay collection, Navigating Disaster, 16 Essays of Love and a Poem of Despair. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Susan. It's great to hear from you.
Oh, you too. Now, a lot of these essays were begun at a studio in the woods. Would you describe the studio and your residency there?
Yes. A studio in the woods now is run by Tulane University, but when I was out there, it was Joe and Lucienne Carmichael who had built this place for artists and writers to have a retreat and also at the same time to take care of an area of forest. And so while I was there by myself, except for Joe and Lucienne, and they didn't bother me much, although I loved talking to them. And it was a very quiet place where I was able to walk around in the woods. There are very old oak trees there, being protected from the privet, which is running wild. And there's a small pond and lots of birds and green anoles, the lizards, which I wrote an essay about that, and fish, just really, really wonderful. It's out in Algiers, just outside of the Mississippi River, the levee there.
But it seems a world away, doesn't it? It's a magical, magical place.
Yes, you turn off onto the road there, and you really feel as if you're going into another world. And I just fell in love with it when I was there.
And also, many of these essays deal with a pilgrimage you made to Alaska, which sounds like an amazing and life-changing journey.
Yes, it is. And it may at first sound strange to have essays about Alaska in a collection that's primarily about Louisiana. But as I talk about in one of my essays, Alaska has a lot in common, Southeast Alaska, with Louisiana, South Louisiana. They're both extreme places at the edge of the map, really. There are large French populations, actually, in both areas. Fishing is really important. They both are areas that are really, really important to me.
And have you been back since that original trip?
I have not. I'm trying to plan a trip right now with my husband.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
Well, I love that title, A Cajun in Alaska, and to drink a glacier.
Yeah, it's interesting. I paid a lot of attention to the Native American population while I was there. I fell in love with the Tlingit and the Haida and all of the artwork that they do, the masks and the totem poles. But there were also some really sad things that I saw. There were a lot of drinking, a lot of alcoholism, and it made me think of my own culture, the Cajun culture, and how we were struggling to bring that culture back, and how, at least in my family, there are some issues with alcoholism, and some of it related, I think, to the struggles that our culture has had to stay alive. And it made me see that there was a connection between the two cultures.
And you've been brutally honest about your family troubles and difficulties. How does your family read your work?
Well, it's interesting. I was in Louisiana for the book festival, and I had dinner with my sister and my niece and my mother and shared with them the book. And my sister said, "So am I in here anywhere?" And I said, "On page 79, you're there." But there were some issues when my memoir came out. And just because, you know, my mother wants me to show the best of the family. And I do show that. But I also think it's important to say what's true. But I think they're now used to it. They know that I'm not going to change, that I'm going to say what I think is the truth. And my mother just now says, well, you know, she exaggerates a little bit. But it was a really good meeting, actually. And the project I'm working on now actually has to do with crocheting. And I was talking to my mother about that. And she said, well, you know, your grandmother and your great-grandmother crocheted. So we were able to sort of begin to talk about ways in which there are connections between us that I don't think we'll disagree about in the future.
Well, I know your mother is a great reader and book lover, so yeah. I know she reads all your works.
She does.
I can just imagine the family gatherings. Oh, Cheryl.
Yes, we were arguing about, well, you said I grew up in the Ninth Ward, and really it was right outside of the Ninth Ward. You know, things like that. She'll find small little things, but it's okay. They really are supportive of me, and I appreciate that.
Well, it's the ongoing conversation always. Now, you place a special emphasis on writing about the environment in your creative writing program at Chatham, don't you?
That's right.
So tell me about some of the projects you've done that have been relatively unusual. I know you've brought students to New Orleans, for example.
Right, right. You know, Rachel Carson is an alum of Chatham. That's the one we always brag about. And so we do have in this program an emphasis on environment, on nature writing. And so I teach nature writing. And I did bring the students to Louisiana after Katrina. And we went both to New Orleans and we went to the Atchafalaya Basin because that's a place that I love more than anything else, I think. And I have a friend out there, Greg Girard, who arranges for me to take students out on the bayou. And we also met with Dean Wilson there, who is the bayou keeper, and he took us out too. I actually went twice with students to Louisiana, and we talked a lot about what's happening to the native Cajun culture, and especially with men and women who lived their lives for many years, you know, fishing, catching wild crawfish, frogs, et cetera, and how it's very difficult now to have a living doing that. So we've done that. I've also taken them to Costa Rica and to, I guess my favorite trip was to Ecuador, where we lived in a very, very remote area. We had to take two boats down a tributary of the Amazon. We went for 6 hours and saw a couple of anacondas and wound up in this field research station where the students stayed for 2 weeks, and we traveled. We saw monkeys, we saw birds, we swam in the rivers and learned a lot about all kinds of things that are related to the Amazon jungles in Ecuador. It was really exciting.
Your life gets more adventurous every time I talk to you.
This year we went to Vietnam, and that was more of a cultural trip, but we did go out in central Vietnam and help with planting rice and learned a lot about what it takes to be a farmer in Vietnam. So it's a really great program here, and that's a part of it that I love.
Oh, it sounds like so much fun. The title of your book, Navigating Disaster, is a title that doesn't necessarily go with a subtitle, Essays of Love.
Well, the subtitle, 16 Essays of Love and a Poem of Despair, is actually inspired by a book by a Chilean poet, Pablo Neruda. The first book he ever published was called 21 Poems of Love and a Song of Despair. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how I've experienced both personal and environmental cultural disasters, but I love New Orleans, for example. But New Orleans is also a place where there's a lot of violence. There's a lot of drugs. It's a difficult place sometimes to bring up a child. I love my father, but my father was an alcoholic. So I was thinking about how in navigating disaster, you actually have to have love involved as well. That all of the things that I write about in this collection are things I love. They're places I love. There are people I love. But sometimes it's a difficult love if you have a relative who is racist, for example. It's difficult to love that part of the relative, although you may love them. Same thing with issues such as alcoholism or addiction. The despair part, the last piece in this collection is a long experimental form poem, and it's called Midnight Oil, and it's thinking about the Gulf oil spill, which was really, really upsetting to me for many, many reasons. And the poem sort of goes all over the place in the same way it moves back and forth over the page, the way that the oil spill did in the Gulf. And I was angry when I wrote that poem. I was very angry about the way that the spill was being handled and how even now, supposedly, it's all finished with. We don't need to worry about it. And I just don't think that's the case. So it's really, more than despair, it's anger, I think. Although I guess the poem itself sort of ends with saying, you know, let's throw this back in the face of the people who really caused this. And so I guess I worry in terms of despair that nothing will be done about preventing something like this from happening again. So that's where the despair comes from.
Oh, and we all feel it. We do,
yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And you came home for the publisher of this book as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I really wanted this book to be published by a Louisiana press. And Louisiana Literature Journal has been very good to me. They've published some of my first forays into fiction. And although it's a small press, I really wanted them to do it. And I think they did a fantastic job with it. And I'm very, very happy with it.
Well, you can tell they did it with love. I mean, it's beautifully done. The writing is so gorgeous. The artwork they've chosen, or you've chosen, is just perfect. It's a really, really special book.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Cheryl St. Germain, whose new book is Navigating Disaster, 16 Essays of Love and a Poem of Despair. Don't miss it. Thanks so much, Cheryl.
Thank you, Susan.
Books inspire so many things: great movies, beautiful paintings, and yes, wonderful music. So here's a listen to some songs inspired by literature. It's amazing how strong the memory of a childhood classic book can be. Steve Hackett's rock song Narnia is from his album, Please Don't Touch. And Noel Venable imagines the Pevensey children returning from those enchanted, dangerous lands in A Midsummer Night's Dream from her album, The World is Bound by Secret Knots.
Turn it around.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Poet Mehta Sama is the special guest Tuesday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel at the reading series sponsored by the 1718 Society, a student-run literary organization of Tulane, Loyola, and UNO. Painter Phil Sandusky discusses his work and signs his new book, New Orleans Impressionist Cityscapes, Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses John M. Harrison's Viraconium, Saturday, January 12th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Miles Arsenault, that's the pen name for John Davis, discusses and signs his book, Thin Slice of Life, Monday, January 14th at 4 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. John Gegenheimer discusses and signs The Second Hill, Monday, January 14th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This event is part of the Fiction Writers Group, a support group for people who are interested in creating fiction. Not nonfiction, not essays, not poetry. Events rotate between critiques of member submissions, author appearances, and writing exercises. William Rao discusses and signs his book, 19th Century European Painting, From Barbizon to La Belle Époque, Tuesday, January 15th from 5:30 to 7 at Garden District Bookshop. And Tulane Law School's Vernon Palmer discusses and signs Through the Codes Darkly, Tuesday, January 15th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.